This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And on the line with us is our old friend Greg Palast, the investigative reporter, investigative journalist, just all-around good guy and general genius. Hey, Greg, welcome back to the program.
Glad to be with you, Tom, again.
And I should say, author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, which you can watch on Amazon. You can stream it for $2. And GregPalast.com is website. So, Greg, this is the first chance you and I have had a talk since the election in Georgia's 6th. And I know you were down there doing research on it. You were on this program last week or the week before talking about what you learned down there. Tell us what you know now, a couple of days after the election.
Well, I mean, officially, Karen Handel, the Republican, won, and the referendum on Trump won. That's the wonderful story. And with 100% of the precincts reporting, according to the New York Times, with 100% reporting, you have Handel winning by about 3.5%, 11,000 votes. That's official. Now, the reality, which isn't official. When we report vote tolls in America, we do something that they don't do in England or France or anywhere else. We don't report the votes that weren't counted. That is, I expect to have 10,000-20,000 provisional ballots there. That's when people show up to the polls. Their names are missing from the voter rolls. They're giving these write-in ballots. I call them placebo ballots because they let you think you voted, but you haven't. We're going to see thousands of those, maybe tens of thousands of those in the Georgia 6th. They haven't reported any of those. We won't even get a number till tomorrow, and I don't even know if it'll be honest. We also don't report spoiled votes, that is, mistakes in the machine where votes aren't counted. That's usually about 1.5% of the vote. I think here it will be higher. Why do I think these numbers are significant and higher? Because if you saw my last reports with you, or you go to GregPalast.com and get the whole video reports from there, you'll see that we had tens of thousands of voters who were registered by African American and Asian American voter registration organizations whose names were never entered on the voter rolls. So if they show up to vote, they might get a provisional ballot, but it won't be counted because their names are not on the rolls.
Yeah, it was to the tune of something like 10,000 Korean ancestry Americans and 40,000 African Americans, am I remembering right?
That's right. Not all of them were in the 6th, but it was concentrated. The effort was concentrated in Georgia's 6th congressional CD. So you literally have groups like New Georgia Project and once the Asian American Legal Advocacy Center who were collecting votes. And then those after they were actually raided by the Republican state officials on cockamamie grounds, which are all dropped and threatening these people with criminal charges for registering voters. But it shut down some of the registration drive. It scared away a lot of people. And they still did not win in court the right to get the names that they collected put on the voter rolls in time for this vote. Hmm. In addition, and this is something that I want to credit the Nate Cohn of the New York Times for this. You have about half the vote in that district was early voting, Tom. And overwhelmingly, those are Democratic votes. African Americans tend to do Souls to the Polls Day on Sundays. They vote early. You had Ossoff winning the early vote by nearly 2-1. So why didn't that put him over? The answer was actually a great job by Nate Cohn, who gave us a map that said they'd move the early polling places out of Democratic DeKalb County, northern Atlanta, and move them north into the Republican districts. And he says, as you move away from an early voting station, the number of people who vote early massively drops off. In other words, if the polling station's down the street, you'll go. If it's 4 miles away, especially if you don't have a car, you're less a heck of a lot less likely to go. That's a big district. Some of those polling stations were 15 miles away.
Yeah, DeKalb County
also had tremendous
huge
problems. Yeah. It's huge, and that's only one of the three counties in the district. And so they moved the early polling stations out of DeKalb, which is the Democratic area.
Right.
This is just one of the many tricks, not registering the voters. And we also had tremendous problems where people were showing up at the polls, not finding their names on the rolls, who'd already been registered and had voted many years at the same polling station. And we had mentioned that Karen Handel personally, the Republican candidate, admitted to me, in fact, she was proud that they were purging the voter rolls in her district on a system called CrossCheck, which we've discussed before. It's about accusing people of voting twice. They don't vote twice, but if your name is common, like John Black, who is almost certain to be an African-American, you could lose your vote because they said you voted somewhere else. They were shifting polling stations. I talked to Reverend Jenkins of the Eagles Nest Church. He and his wife voted at the same place for years. They showed up together to vote. And what happened, they said his wife, who lives obviously with the pastor, had a vote at a far-flung station. So she went to the other station. This is a husband and wife at the same house, shifted. She showed up at the other place and says, oh, you're not listed here. You'll have to fill out a provisional ballot. She raised hell because she knows her rights and was able to avoid that provisional ballot. But most people have no idea what's happening. And so does this account for the 11,000, the 3.5% vote total difference? I normally don't speculate, so I won't. I'll say it absolutely yes. Because if you take away the number of people who should have been on those voter rolls and not registered, if you take away the shenanigans with the early voting, if we take a look into the spoilage bin of votes, and according to the Civil Rights Commission, your chance your vote will spoil, that is some technical reason why your vote didn't count, is 900% higher if you're Black than if you're white. You put all those things together, and I don't think that handle, if you had a complete, total, fair vote of all eligible voters, that handle had won. So Trump won his referendum the way Trump won his presidency, by shoplifting it.
Right. This was voter suppression. Greg, you've been on this beat for a long, long time. I mean, you were the one who, yeah, when you were reporting for the BBC, exposed the all the African-Americans in Florida that Jeb Bush threw off the voting rolls so that his brother could get within 536 votes of stealing the presidency. Yes. Why is it that the media absolutely, with the singular exception of Joy Reid putting you on her show on MSNBC over the weekend, to the best of my knowledge, that's about it. Why is it that the media in this country, and the Democratic Party for that matter, why is Nancy Pelosi not, you know, the night of the election or today as these numbers are coming out, why are the Democratic Party and the corporate media in this country not discussing this?
Well, this is very interesting. And by the way, I want to underscore your point, in this country, I work for the mainstream media in the rest of the world. That is BBC, Rolling Stone. Rolling Stone here is not the mainstream. BBC, The Guardian. These are the main English language news outlets of the world. And so these reports are mainstream. The rest of the world does know what's going on, but we don't. Why? Well, you bring up Nancy Pelosi, who's actually talked to me and is a big fan of mine. Why doesn't she bring these things up? You know, this is factual matter. I'm not speculating. We know that the groups had registered tens of thousands of people in the district and their names never appeared. This is in court records. Why don't they bring it up? Because they've started this trope, the Democratic Party, that the Russians stole the election. The Russians, the Russians, the Russians. And when Donald Trump said he might not accept the results of the election, the Democratic Party and Hillary Clinton began with no Democratic candidate or no candidate for president in history has ever challenged the vote, the presidential vote. That's insanely wrong. Most in our history, in our 200-year history, you know, Tom, that half the elections have been challenged. And Al Gore went to the United States Supreme Court to overturn the results, the clearly fixed results in Florida. Right. So, but the Democratic Party has decided that anyone who brings up, who says that the American electoral system is anything but the envy of the world, to use Joe Biden's phrase, you know, that you're suddenly a conspiracy nut. It's just like they switched on Comey. He was the devil itself. I mean, Hillary Clinton blamed him for her loss. Now he's Martin Luther Comey, a man for all seasons, because he's now attacking Trump. So range of permitted.
So are you suggesting that the Democratic Party is essentially not capable of chewing gum and walking at the same time? I mean, why can't you say, hey, we have questions about, you know, what the Russians might have been doing, and our voting system is, you know, our people of color are getting thrown off the vote all over our country?
Well, you know, you'll find something interesting if you look at the reports. You'll get a few reports about what they call vote suppression, which is a term I despise. Someone steals your car, Tom. You don't say, my car's been suppressed. But it's right. Vote theft. And you can talk about vote suppression, a fuzzy term. Before the election, you'll have a couple people like Barbara Arnwine, some experts say, oh, the ID is reducing the ability of African-Americans to vote and poor people and students to vote. By the way, the ID laws are the worst in the nation in Georgia, and they were designed by Karen Handel, the candidate, when she was Secretary of State. So she designs the laws that make it easier for her to win the vote and stop. I don't mind if she wins. The problem is that if she wins by stopping black people and students from voting, which is what she did, you'll get a few stories before the election, never, ever after. You just don't see any stories following up saying, well, exactly how many votes did the ID laws in Georgia block? We know that in Wisconsin, a study by the Brennan Center put it at 300,000 people lost their votes because of ID laws. So you think about Georgia, which is worse, and the 6CD. I mean, between ID laws, between the cross-check purges, between failing to register people, between provisional ballots thrown in the garbage, it wasn't a fair vote. And you won't get that. They won't allow that story to come out because it breaks the myth of the wonderful American democracy we have.
Yeah, well, that's a sad thing. Greg Palast, the absolutely brilliant investigative journalist, author, and filmmaker. You've got to see his movie. If you haven't seen it yet, it's available on Amazon. The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. GregPalast.com, the website. You can tweet him at Greg_Palast, P-A-L-A-S-T. Greg, thanks so much for being with us.
You're the best, Tom. Thank
you. Great talking with you, Greg. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Back with your calls. This healthcare bill, what's the consequence going to be for you in this thing? We'll be right back. And welcome back, Johnny in Lamarck, Texas. Hey, Johnny, thanks for watching Free Speech on DirecTV. What's on your mind?
Thank you for doing what you do. You make being surrounded by Republicans here in Lamarck tolerable.
Okay, good. I'm glad I'm performing a public service.
I think you're alluding to the yearly budget of FS Free Speech TV being roughly equal to the salary, the yearly salary, I guess, of the average talking head on corporate TV. Is that correct?
It's about half, actually, of the average salary. Yes, the Free Speech TV operates on a $3 million a year budget, and I, you know, I know for a fact that at least one of the evening hosts on MSNBC is making $7 million.
Yeah, so even if we go really, really conservative and say that Joe Scarborough, Mika Brzezinski, Rachel Maddow,
I think they're making
Sean Hannity and all those guys, if we could just assume for them that they make a $1 million salary, which is really ridiculously low.
Well, I think Joe and Mika are making $20
million. Whoa.
Yeah, whoa. I've seen that number in the press. I don't have personal knowledge of it.
Okay, well, that makes the numbers even easier then. You consider the median income right now is around $50,000, $55,000 a year. Is that correct?
Yeah, in that neighborhood. I've seen numbers as low as 48, but yeah, let's go for that.
So let's just say $50,000 a year is the average the median American salary.
It's actually the average household income. The actual individual income, I think, is in the high 20s or low 30s, because most households have more than one person working. But anyhow, continue, Johnny.
Okay, so bearing these numbers, at half a percent of someone making a gross yearly salary of $50,000, that translates to about $20.83 a month, which is $250 a year, which is doable. So if we say that same thing, if we apply that to a $1 million salary, that's like $417 a month or $5,000 a year. And we can easily find 200 people of that caliber to donate $5,000 a year or $1 million of that $3 million FST.
Well, we're working on it, Johnny. Johnny, we only have a minute and a half left. You called about health care?
No.
Oh.
We could work a guilt trip on these people, get a bunch of volunteers who watch Free Speech TV and follow Hannity and all those folks who have a common anger,
mm-hmm.
and get them to work a guilt trip on their respective talking heads.
Ah, okay. So you
could easily raise $1 million for Free Speech TV a year and have a little left over for Pacific Radio and other nonprofit media.
Yeah. Well, our goal for this fundraising drive, I think, is a little over 300,000. So, but we do it four times a year and that plus some foundation grants there's a couple of wealthy donors, makes up the budget. And I'd say I'm not, you know, part of, I mean, my show is carried on Free Speech TV, but I have no say in the network. I'm just, you know, one of the shows that they carry. But I'm a big fan of the network.
Every once in a while, mention to folks that if they get together with their compatriots across the other media landscape, there's enough angry Americans who have enough in common that we can start working a guilt trip on these multi-million-dollar salaried people.
Yeah. Well, at least those who may have our point of view in mind. And there are a lot of wealthy people who are progressive, who, you know, who get it. It's just that the right-wing wealthy people, they have it's reached the point where they view it as an investment. You know, if I put, you know, $100,000 or $1 million, $10 million into buying a bunch of legislators, I'm going to see a tax cut. And I'll get back, you know, I spend $10 million on politicians, I get back $50 million in tax breaks. And it's just a cold calculation that these guys are making. Johnny, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for supporting Free Speech TV. It's great to hear from you. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Healthcare is the topic du jour, although it's anything goes summer, so whatever you want to talk about. But I know a lot of people are pretty cranked about this giant, $600 to $800 billion tax break over the next 10 years for the billionaire class in the United States that is going to be, and that money is going to be extracted out of Medicaid by and large via so-called repeal and replace of Obamacare. It's really, this is not none of the above. This is just a tax break. Jim in Norwood, New Jersey. Hey, Jim, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, thanks for taking my call. I have a simple point. You know, the difference between a corporate Democrat and a progressive, the definitive issue is health care, single payer.
Is it a right or a
privilege? If you're not for single payer, you're a corporate Democrat, period. End of story. And I think that people should make that point very clear to their representatives, you know, because that's, you know, if you're going to keep the insurance companies in the game, then, you know, you're a corporate Democrat. And then you're, you know, you're liable to all the things that corporate welfare recipients
I don't disagree, Jim. And my prediction is that within 6 months, you will hear Nancy Pelosi and the structural Democrats, the leadership, the power sources within the Democratic Party, essentially say the same thing you just said, except they wouldn't use the word corporate Democrats. But they're going to say these are the values that the Democratic Party is committed to, and healthcare as a right and not a privilege. Through Medicare for all across the United States, I predict within 6 months will be the official position of the Democratic Party. It was arguably the official position of the Democratic Party in the last election, in the 2016 election. It was in the platform, but you know, putting something in a presidential party platform and making it, you know, an official position of the party are slightly different things. But I think that's the direction it's going to go. I got to move along, Jim. Thanks for the call. Well said, Michael. In Asheville, North Carolina, listening on 880 AM, The Revolution. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Oh, hello. Thanks for taking my call, and thank you for your progressive stance. I'm a long-time first time, and I want to talk about how it's today.
Michael, I'm having a hard time hearing you. Can you talk right into the microphone? Uh-oh.
Hello?
Michael?
Yes. Can you hear me now?
I think so.
Okay. Yeah, I wanted to say, I'm a long-time first time. I want to talk about how the ACA has been good for me.
Okay.
I spent prior years living to make insurance payments. And now I can live and not worry about health issues or bankruptcy. And, for me personally, I'll be on Medicaid next year, but they want to ask that too.
Right. So the Affordable Care Act has given you health insurance, and the Republicans want to take away your health insurance. Is that the net of this?
That's absolutely right. And I want to make one comment I hope will sink in, and that is there's no such thing as Trump care. There's Obamacare, and there's Trump care less.
Yeah, yeah. Trump couldn't care less. And this is the bizarre thing, is that he campaigned on a platform of, I'm going to give you better health insurance than Obamacare at a lower price that covers more things And we can do that, you know? And now he said, oh, gee, this is complicated. Well, it's only complicated if all the Republicans are taking money from billionaires who don't want to see their taxes go up. Michael, or who are upset because 8 years ago their taxes did go up. Michael, thank you for the call. Spot on. We'll be back. Look around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
Coming up on 28 minutes past the hour, back with your calls. How is this Republican plan going to affect you? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. You know what the title, the name of this piece of legislation is? I mean, this is mind-boggling. It's House Resolution 1628, but it actually has a name. And the name is the Elimination of Limitations on Recapture of Excess Advance Payments of Premium. Excuse me, of premium tax credits. The Elimination of Limitation on Recapture of Excess Advance Payments of Premium Tax Credits. That's the name of the bill. They said this act may be cited as the Better Care Reconciliation Act of 2017, but that's not the actual legal name of it. The actual legal name is the Elimination of Limitation on Recapture of Excess Advance Payments of Premium Tax Credits. Tell me this is not a tax bill. This is exclusively a tax bill. It's just that in order to stop taxing the billionaires and give them back all that money, they have to take it out of our national healthcare system. So the 75 million Americans who are on Medicaid are screwed. Now, they're going to do it over a seven-year period. You're not screwed this year or next year. You know, next year's an election year. Or the year after that or the year after that, it's not so bad. It goes 90%, 85, 80, 75. But then after the election year, after 2020, it starts sliding down really, really fast. This is just an abomination. I don't know how to describe it beyond that. It's just, this is so evil. Donald in Aurora, Illinois. Hey, Donald, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. You know, I'm wondering if you can correct me on my thinking, because whenever the Republicans get up there and they start slamming President Obama's Medicare, the Affordable Care Act, they always say that it's failing and it's not working and it's collapsing and all these hospitals are pulling out. Right. Now, can I honestly say, in the way I feel, that they, the Republican Party, are the cause of it? Because 61 times they tried to repeal it. They shut down the government so it wouldn't be subsidized. If what I'm saying and feeling is the truth, that they're actually choking it so they can create a crisis, then why aren't the Democrats screaming about that, pointing the fingers at these people and mentioning names?
You know, Donald, I have been pounding on that for the better part of six years. as the Republicans have been trying to repeal this, and in large part over the last 2 years. 2 years ago, Marco Rubio and people who regularly listen to the whole program, I probably can recite this in their sleep because I've done this rant so many times. There's this thing called risk corridors, where the first 10 years of Obamacare, the federal government said to the health insurance companies, we're going to do an experiment, right? We're going to cover everybody, even if they have pre-existing conditions, no matter how sick they are, you are going to provide them with insurance and we are going to pay you for that. And we don't really know what it's going to cost. So every year at the end of the year, if you lost money on your Obamacare policies, document how much money you lost to us and we will write you a check for that amount of money. So that for the first decade, the health insurance companies were absolutely kept safe. They were held harmless. They were protected. And they referred to these payments as risk corridors, like they were the gutters in a bowling alley, you know, that the ball can slide into. And, you know, once if it goes awry and then once it hits the gutter, it's not going to go crazy anywhere else. It's just, you know, they called these the risk corridors that the health insurance companies, you know, could kind of slide into if they were losing money. So they would be just fine. And Obamacare was working just fine up until about 2 years ago because the risk corridors were there. Then Marco Rubio sponsored an amendment to one of the big omnibus appropriations bills. And that amendment eliminated the risk corridors. So, bang, that was a major shock. And that caused a number of health insurance companies to get badly rattled. But that said, they were 7 or 8 years into this 10-year process. And so most of them had reached the point where they'd pretty much figured out the economics of it all. The second thing that happened was that the individual states were given the option by the Supreme Court of their state insurance commissioners allowing insurance policies to be sold in the state that do not comply with the minimum standards of Obamacare. Now, California didn't do this. California said, you know, if you're going to sell a health insurance policy in California, it has to meet the standards of Obamacare. It had these 10 core things. It will pay for hospitalization. It will pay for emergency rooms. It will pay for maternity care. That's the one thing Republicans hate, which is weird because they're supposedly pro-life. It will pay for, but they're anti-woman, so then it kind of makes sense. It will pay for, you know, psychological services, addiction treatment, things like that. So there's these 10 things that are the basis of Obamacare. And what happened in Iowa, which is the state where most recently all the major health insurance companies have pulled out, is they said, we're going to take the waiver on this that the Supreme Court gave us, and we're going to allow insurance companies to sell crap policies in Iowa. So because young, healthy people, by and large, don't need health insurance. I mean, everybody needs it because you can get in a car accident tomorrow. But they're not, you know, they're convinced of their own immortality. And so if they're looking at a $300 a month Obamacare policy versus a $200 a month policy that doesn't, you know, only covers the first $50,000 of hospitalization and doesn't cover pre-existing conditions. But hey, you're 25 years old, you don't have any pre-existing conditions. You go with the cheap policy. So in Iowa, what happened was all these young people, by young, I mean under 30, under 35, basically, they were buying these cheaper policies in the independent marketplace. And the only people who were buying the Obamacare policies were the people who were sick enough that the insurance companies wouldn't sell them the cheap policies, and or the cheap policies didn't cover the things that they needed. And as a result of that, the Obamacare, the people selling in the Obamacare exchanges were losing money. And because Marco Rubio took away the risk corridors, they couldn't afford to continue. So that's the second thing that happened. Then the third thing that happened is that there is this provision. There still are subsidies, and the way that the subsidies work, if you depending on how much money you make, if you buy an insurance policy that costs, and I put that in air quotes, costs $500 a month, but you actually only pay $300 a month of that, you know, the $200 extra is coming from a subsidy from the federal government, which is covered by the insurance companies. In other words, the insurance companies only charge you the $300 and or the $200 or whatever my example was. And the balance of that, they bill the federal government for. And Trump, the Trump administration, is saying, we're not sure we're going to cut those checks. They're refusing to say whether they will reimburse the health insurance companies for the subsidies. And the health insurance companies are going, wait a minute, if you don't cut the checks, we're screwed. And so they're pulling out of, you know, markets where there's any uncertainty at all. Now they're way past worrying about risk corridors in states like California that said you know the only policies that can be sold in our state are Obamacare compliant policies. Then Obamacare works brilliantly. You expand Medicaid, you make all the policies Obamacare compliant, and everything works. But California will take one of the biggest hits from this Republican plan because it's cutting the subsidies and it's cutting the Medicaid expansion. So, you know, Georgia won't be hurt so bad because they never expanded Medicaid, but California will be hurt very badly. So those are the three ways that the Republican Party, Donald, has sabotaged Obamacare up to this point with the complicity of the Supreme Court, who made it all possible. John Roberts was the principal architect of this, and Antonin Scalia. And now, of course, the Republicans, you know, what they do is they break things. And Reagan was the master of this, you know, cut back the budget of a department, you know, to the point where it no longer works and then say, hey, look at that department isn't working. The Department of Education is not functioning. Let's do away with it. Right. You know, Social Security is running. Let's do away with it. I mean, this was George W. Bush's thing in 2005 when he actually tried to privatize Social Security and finally gave up because, you know, because of all the backlash he got. But yeah. This is what they do. They break things that they don't like, you know, when they get power, and then they point out that it's broken, and they say, don't worry, we'll fix it. And their fix is always to destroy it and, you know, return the money back to the billionaires. Make sense, Donald?
That seems to be happening now.
Yes, it absolutely is happening now. Donald, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. Pat in Beloit, Wisconsin. Hey, Pat, what's up?
Well, I'm going to give you several points of view on this. First of all, for me personally, because I have had cancer frequently, I have a pre-existing condition, and I was married to my job for, well, now close to 30 years because I had good health insurance.
Right.
That's how things affect you. And I mean, I love my job, but I had no choice to stay with it. And secondly, I'm concerned that they're going to take the lifetime cap off of it, and then I will be in jeopardy again because the pre-existing condition issue is okay. But if they take the lifetime cap off, I've been with the district a long time. I could be in big trouble.
No, I know it well. I mean, 4 years ago, I think it was, maybe five, Louise had breast cancer and I had prostate cancer in the same year. And our health insurance company sent us a letter saying, you know, you're getting close to your limit. You know, pretty soon we're going to pay you nothing because you both had surgery. And, you know, it's crazy. I mean, it's just it's absolutely crazy. That's not insurance. That's lottery.
And the other thing is, working with a school district, I work with special ed kids, okay? We receive money back for some of the services through Medicaid. So this is another way to attack the schools also, because if we don't receive that reimbursement, it will affect the school financially.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. So it's a twofer for the Trump administration. They get to promote Betsy DeVos's privatized, corporatized, for-profit, you know, hustle schools, Trump University schools. And they get to give the billionaires a $600 billion tax cut. Pat, thank you for that.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with more of your calls in just a minute. And welcome back. Joe in Cupertino, California, watching Free Speech on DirecTV. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Tom, can you hear me?
Just fine.
Okay, great. Love your show. Got the kids in the car coming back from summer school, but what a spot-on topic. I've yet to be able to decipher what mnemonic I want to use for this rollout from the Senate, but see if I care comes to mind. However, I digress.
See if I care?
Today, yeah, see if I care.
Yeah, okay.
Anyway, in California, we're making great strides here. There's a little bit of a confusion that's going on with the the assembly, as they're trying to factor how we're going to pay for this. And I read it yesterday, and I'm going off the top of my head, but I wanted to clarify for the voters and the listeners in California, but more importantly, you who know the federal system so well, that you can appreciate where in California they're trying to figure out how to pay for this. Now, currently,
you're talking about the single payer that's been proposed in California?
Exactly.
Yeah.
They're talking about a $400 billion ticket for this rollout. They'll fail to mention, though, that they're currently paying $358 million today without it. However, in order to pay for this, and they're going from a study that was conducted by the University of Massachusetts, and they're suggesting that they can implement this program with nothing more than a small 2.3% tax increase on businesses earning over $2 million a year in order to help offset the cost. We're going to reduce the cost for everybody with no premiums, no co-payments, no prescription drug plan. It's all covered, dental and vision. And we're going to do so, and all we're going to do is we're going to ask those employers that have, you know, 50, 100, they're earning over $2 million a year in taxable income to kick in a 2.3% increase in their revenue to help offset the cost. They no longer pay for health insurance for their employees, so it's really a win-win on both sides.
Yep.
The other point is, that it's being addressed by the governor is not something that he wants to back, which is unfortunate, but he's a great governor. Gavin's going to be even better, but we're just hoping. And the other thing here, we have Nancy and Diane, both, who are kind of, I don't want to say skittish, because I know how much they're loved, but I'd like to see him step out front here and say, look, we can do it in California. We can show the rest of the nation. But I don't see that coming from them. So maybe some of this talk about changing up in the leadership isn't all that bad. because this is a doable situation if we can just get the voters to understand that it's we the people, not our representatives that are corporate Democrats, to step forward and say, yes, this will show how misguided the Republicans are to the rest of the world, and we would be able to demonstrate significantly in 2020 why our way is better. What do you think?
Yeah, I think so. And the example of Saskatchewan and Tommy Douglas is the big one. I mean, Tommy Douglas was the premier of Saskatchewan back in the 60s when they rolled out their single-payer health insurance program, and, you know, funded just by the province, by the what we would call a state here in the United States. And it worked so well that every other province in Canada wanted it. And over the next decade or so, every other province picked it up, and eventually the federal government, the federal Canadian government, hopped in to kind of backstop them and coordinate. But they're still all administered by the states, I believe, or by the provinces. And if California, and this, by the way, this is, you know, Bernie on this program maybe 6 or 8 years ago, you know, I was like, shouldn't we have a national Medicare for all? And he was like, no, it really should be, every state does it. And I was like, why? And he said, because then they can experiment with, you know, ways to make it better, make it work better. It's more local control, which is like, you know, kind of democracy 101. Joe, I hope California gets it. I really do. Thanks a lot for the call. We'll be right back. Victoria Jones up next. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's check in with Talk Media News, find out what's going on in the world today. This report brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and Loving What You Do, Alan Ratner's new book. On the line with us, Victoria Jones from Talk Media News. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So Donald Trump tweets out this morning, with all the recently reported electronic surveillance intercepts, unmasking, and illegal leaking of information, I have no idea whether there are tapes or recordings of my conversations with James Comey, but I did not make and do not have any such recordings. How is this being received in Washington?
Well, it was pretty recent. It was within the hour. But I can tell you that in the press corps, it is being received fairly, not skeptically, but the Sarah Huckabee Sanders has been questioned about it at the White House off-camera briefing today, and she basically says that, you know, the tweets speak for themselves, and she won't really be drawn on them very much. I think it's what is being asked is, well, does he think that he is being surveilled? And you know, as a result of these two tweets, because he could have just said that I did not make and do not have any such recordings, which to me sounds like lawyer's language, to be honest with you. But the other tweet, the first tweet with all the recently reported electronic surveillance intercepts, unmasking, and illegal leaking of information, that sounds like he's setting it up to say that somebody else recorded them, right. I.e., the intelligence community.
So he thinks that the NSA or the CIA are bugging the Oval Office. Is that the deal?
Well, who knows? Who knows what he means by that?
Amazing.
Once again, he dropped something down there. You know, you just don't know. And there was really no answer as to one question which was asked, which was, why did he put this out there weeks and weeks and weeks ago and then not answer it until basically a day before a deadline had been set?
Because today is the beginning of season two. This is a reality show.
Yes. Well, it's not going down very well, this particular one. And, of course, it is taking away from, once again, he's stepping on the news of the day,
right,
which is healthcare.
Which I think he wants to do. I Drudge is not even reporting it, or at least it's not on their headlines. Fox, I've been watching Fox for the last 2 hours, and they occasionally mention it, but they mention it, everything I can tell, just from looking at the chyrons and on the screen. They've been talking about all kinds of other things, particularly how unpopular Hillary Clinton is. That's been the major Fox theme throughout the morning. But they've also been, now they're calling out Rand Paul and three other Republican senators, saying they may not vote for it, essentially saying to their base of people who watch this billionaire-funded television network, you know, Rupert Murdoch's network, call these four Republican senators and tell them to vote for a $600 billion tax cut for billionaires like Rupert Murdoch.
Well, and this is it. We don't know. You know, CNN is reporting that at least three Republican senators were expected to oppose the health bill. Senator Ted Cruz may introduce an amendment, which would be something that would be very popular with the House Freedom Caucus. We don't know whether Senator Mitch McConnell would allow him to have it, and that could upset him. And Senator Mike Lee, we don't know whether Rand Paul's a no. He could be. We don't know about Senator Ron Johnson either. He was indicating today that he might not have enough time to review it. And, of course, Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski are probably not happy at all about the planned parenthood defunding. So that could be a potential five. Who knows? But I think that John Cornyn might have his whip out over the weekend with all of these people.
Yeah. We'll see. What else is up?
Well, I should mention that Capitol Police are arresting dozens of people who are protesting the cuts to Medicaid in the health bill. The protesters filled a hallway in one of the Senate office buildings outside the office of Mitch McConnell. Some of them are being escorted individually. Others were very reluctant to leave. It's taking four or five officers to carry them out. Some of them were in wheelchairs. And there's some video of this, of people, of one woman in particular. I saw a video on Twitter of a woman in a wheelchair. She looked to be very disabled, and she was carried out by four or five officers. And they're yelling, no cuts to Medicaid, as they're being led away.
Yeah, this was in the Russell Building in front of Mitch McConnell's office.
Yeah. Yes, so that's going on. Other things that are going on today, quite a few things. We have got a bipartisan pair of senators has introduced a bill aimed at bolstering expertise in the military justice system by creating a career litigation track for the Judge Advocate General Corps. That's JAG. And this is Senator Joni Ernst, Republican of Iowa. She's saying that the lack of specialized JAG litigators is an injustice to our service members who may be hindered from receiving the best trial possible. Right now, the military lawyers in the Army, Air Force, and Marines rotate between assignments from prosecutor to administrative lawyer. They don't specialize. The Navy,
they're all generalists,
gets them to specialize, yes. Now, Senator Kirsten Gillibrand from New York, along with Ernst, they saying that each brand must allow some of the JAGs to specialize in litigation. And this has been brought up many times. And they're both saying that this will allow victims of sexual assault and other crimes to get legal advice from well-qualified, experienced, specialized JAGs in the military justice system.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good thing.
So that's interesting. And we'll see where that bill goes. The Supreme Court ruled today that a naturalized immigrant cannot be stripped of their citizenship for making false statements during the naturalization process that are irrelevant to an immigration official's decision to grant or deny citizenship.
What was the statement in question?
It was a Bosnian woman who lied about her husband being involved in a Bosnian militia unit that had been implicated in war crimes. It had nothing to do with her own citizenship.
Oh, I see.
But the government was saying it should be anything, and it was a unanimous opinion. And Justice Elena Kagan said, well, you could have lied about a traffic ticket, and the government could be holding things over you for years and investigating you.
Right. Yeah, it's like once you've got it, you've got it. That's the end of that.
Right. That was what the court said.
Good. Victoria Jones with Talk Media News. Victoria, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Great talking. We'll be back. Stick around. Kathy Kelly is going to be with us, a founding member of Voices in the Wilderness. And this is all about Afghanistan. What's going on? Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.